Women's E-News seems to not be loading today, so we're just going to go straight to you, Michelle, and tell us a little bit about what KC Healthy Kids Project is.
Sure. So KC Healthy Kids, we're a local nonprofit, and we're celebrating our 10-year anniversary this year. And what we try to do is empower communities, policymakers, schools, and especially kids to reshape our region so the healthy choice is the easy choice for everyone in Kansas City.
And what is it that you do to promote these things?
We work on all facets of health. So we really work on system and policy level change. So within the organization, we have a policy team that works with local government and also in Topeka and Jeff City, working with those high-level policymakers to really shape public policy around health. We also work directly with local neighborhood associations and our Healthy Community Initiative. So we work with the neighborhood associations trying to provide technical assistance and help them mobilize their community around health. And then we have our school and youth-based programming. So one is our farm-to-school program, which connects schools and food service with local growers trying to increase the amount of local fresh produce in schools. And then the program I'm in charge of is the I Am Here Youth Advocacy Program, which empowers kids to speak out for those system and policy-level changes around health.
So do these do the kids do a lot of this discovery on their own, or is this very adult-led or a child-led?
So the idea is that it's a child-led initiative, but I would say traditionally even most adults don't really think about where they live or where they work, play, go to school, and how that affects their health. Most people think of health as an individual habit choice. So if I eat right and I exercise, I'll be healthy. But for a lot of our neighborhoods in Kansas City, they may not have a place where they can be active as a family. Kids in school, a lot of times they're sitting 8 hours a day. Or they don't necessarily have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. What if you're on free and reduced lunch and you're dependent on a school lunch? What that school lunch looks like for breakfast and lunch is very important to your day. So there's a lot of those just even procedures and policies in our lives that make it really difficult to be healthy, even though we may have the best intentions in the world. So with this I Am Here program, what it really does is we partner with all kinds of different organizations for it. So schools, community groups that work with kids. And basically it's a really unique program that it's the first time anyone, I think, is really introducing those ideas to kids at a young age. Our target group is grades 3 through 8. So we're starting pretty young with kids, having them think critically about their surroundings. And then from there, it's all student-led. So once we kind of introduce the concept to them, it's the kids' ideas. So what do they think are the barriers to health in their neighborhood and what's important to them, and having them speak out to those decision makers in their life for change. And so it's very student-centered once you get the introduction to the concept on.
And are they coming up with ideas that you wouldn't have come up with as an adult? Is this kind of enlightening?
I think it is, because a lot of times adults come in and experts come in and we go into a place and we decide, well, this is what you need to do, healthy, be healthy, and here are the steps you should follow. And a lot of times those things aren't important to kids. And so you may have all the best standards and policies and procedures in the world, but if they're not jiving with what a kid thinks, it's not going to be successful. So because the program is fairly new, we started with this about 3 years ago, and it started simply as a photo contest where we asked kids to take pictures of their surroundings and say, give us a short caption of why it's healthy or not healthy, getting them to think about those type of things. And one neighborhood in that very first year we were working with, they had all these ideas about creating new sidewalks and getting the community out and walking together and being active. And it was kids who brought up the issue that, well, we don't really feel safe walking to school because there's stray dogs and there's snakes in our neighborhood because of some abandoned buildings. And so we had all these community partners together thinking about, you know, ways to improve the walkability of this neighborhood, and it took a kid to say really what was going on for those type of things. And having kids speak out for salad bars in their schools. So a lot of times adults are thinking, well, they won't buy it. We're not going to make any money off of this. And having kids overwhelmingly say, we don't really want the vegetables on the tray. We'd much rather have a choice and be able to pick what we want. And so they're going to eat healthy if you just give them some options. And so those voices are pretty powerful because a lot of times adults assume they know what kids are going to eat or what kids are going to do. And I think a lot of times if it's their idea and they have choice, they're going to run with it so much farther.
Yeah, I don't see an adult going, well, really what we need to improve the health of kids is to worry about snakes.
Yeah, that was definitely out of left field where a lot of us weren't expecting that one as much.
Have you had any other surprises like that? I mean, real barriers where from a kid's eye view,
we've had
things look different.
Yeah, a lot of times people don't think about abandoned buildings as being an issue of health. They think of more of, but with kids walking to school, we've heard that from multiple different classrooms that they're afraid to walk to school because the houses are spooky. They don't know what's going on there. So it makes them feel uncomfortable to even be outside in their own neighborhood. And so when you think about abandoned buildings, you don't really necessarily think about health. And for the kids, that's a huge barrier to them being active. Kids, too, are really perceptive when it comes to school policies and procedures. So recess is always a big thing. So it's pretty traditional. If you act up in class, you get recess taken away. And kids get it almost instantly that, well, I got in trouble because I was wiggling around, and then that recess, I didn't have anywhere to kind of let out all of that energy. And so that was a big one. Another one is just the way recess even looks. So we've had kids where schools had built, you know, a brand new area for kids to play, but the way, let's say, the basketball hoops are set up, that if their games cross over into other games, then it starts fights. Or if there's not enough room for everybody to play, then it starts fights, so people end up just sitting out and not participating. So those are, like, small details that necessarily adults don't think about from when you're planning area.
And then you hear these wonderful things that kids are very self-aware, that kids are, well, I don't really want to exercise because I don't want to be violent. I don't want to get in a fight. I don't want to have... I'm really impressed with the things that you've been hearing from children, and good on you for opening your ears to them. I will say that when we talked about health, I don't think it ever came up that, like, well, maybe you need more recess. I think I would have been much more into health class as an elementary schooler if the health teachers came in and said, you know, you need to have more recess.
Yeah.
You know, your teacher shouldn't take your recess away. You should have more choice on your school lunch. We didn't have choice on anything in school lunch. And I mean, I'm just listening to this going, yes, that would have made me very happy as an elementary school kid. How do we forget that when we become adults? It seems very common sense once you hear it out of their mouths.
Yeah, and I mean, even we forget about it once kids go to middle school, because we do work with 6th through 8th graders as well. And one recently, they, as 7th graders, were really missing having an opportunity to be active during the school day, because you go from elementary school, where at least you have a guarantee of recess every day, to middle school, and you're only a year older, but... You're
no recess.
No, none at all.
Cold turkey quit in recess.
So we have one group that's, they're trying to organize. They start every day in a homeroom. So having an announcement over the intercom of, we're going to do this for like the last at least 5 minutes of homeroom, and then start making it a competition between the different classrooms of who's moving the most during that time. So just trying to incorporate those small things. But those are all kids' ideas versus the adults. And so if your friends are coming up with these ideas, you're much more likely than to do it, even if your teacher is like, now it's activity time. And, you know, as a middle schooler, a lot of times you're really reluctant to follow what the teachers are saying because it's that age where, you know, kids get a little squirrely, but you're much more receptive to your peers at that point. And so it becomes not only kids are thinking about policy and system levels for health, they're also kind of shifting a culture to where the healthy choice is the norm. And it's not the weird idea of well, I need to be healthy and eat my vegetables because my parents or my teachers tell me so.
Michelle, just from some of your comments, is it changing the way we think of education? Like, you know, there's a lot of talk about what to do with education and all the tests and all the things that are going on and what it really means. And just hearing you say the feedback that you're getting from children and what they're saying is important to them, it actually going to implement some of these policies seems like it could actually change their experience of school. I have a 7-year-old nephew, and he's like, I like it, but I just wish it wasn't so long. Or I wish I didn't have to stay there all day and just different things. So do you think that it does change your view of what school can look like in the educational experience in general?
I think so. Before I started at Case Healthy Kids, I was actually a classroom teacher in Kansas City for 6 years, and I think there's a huge shift, and it's definitely coming, of student-centered learning and student discovery learning. So I think what we're doing with that health idea is starting to trickle through in all the subjects. So mm-hmm. whether that's from classroom management, we're having kids decide what their classroom rules should be as a group, to leading their own projects versus a lecture-type classroom. All of those things are really popping up all over education, and I think that's where it's going, and I think it's going to be incredibly powerful for kids as that tends to spread all over the system.
Yeah, nice. Well, you know, I have a nephew who's in the elementary school system as well, and I think he had a different experience with health and trying to teach him how to be healthy, and because one day he just, we went to dinner at their house, and he's just, I hate Michelle Obama. I was like, what? Why? And it's like, she took away our cookies.
Oh.
And that is, I mean, that hurt to a kid. I mean, mm-hmm. and I'm thinking, we had cookies when I was in elementary school, and if somebody took away our cookies, I think I'd be saying the same thing about them. And, I mean, I was a very healthy kid. I was a very active kid. I ate well. I still had a cookie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you heard anything about that? You know, I'll eat really healthy. Just give me a cookie every now and then.
You know, I heard that almost exact same quote from high schoolers when I was teaching. Like, you know, I'm hungry today because they took away this and this from my lunch. And I think what's really powerful about what we're trying to do is the adults aren't taking anything away. We're just putting it out there that this is what's healthy and what would you eat if we had options for you. Mm-hmm. So I know one school we worked with, they currently have an ice cream bar, but they don't have a salad bar. Mm-hmm. And the kids are advocating, one, for the salad bar, but two, to have a parfait and smoothie bar instead of the ice cream bar. So you still can get a treat. You can still get something sweet. And the kids know it's healthy, but it's their idea, so of course they're more likely to eat it, and it's not the adults taking something away. Mm-hmm. It's them just changing up what it looks like at lunch.
Well, we were still allowed to have homemade cookies in class, too, I think. Yeah. We had some lunch ladies that made homemade cookies, and I think that a lot of kids now, maybe they can give up a cookie because it's a prepackaged, terrible cookie. They were not experiencing the cookie that I would have just been very upset to lose. But I do really like that that idea, too. I mean, for kids to reject an ice cream bar.
Mm-hmm. And we've had kids
impressive.
Reject the treats even at Halloween parties. So if you go in and you talk to a classroom and you ask the kids, really, what do you look forward to most for those classroom parties? And most times they're going to say it's the activities. Mm-hmm. The food's pretty low on the list, but a lot of times parents that's how we show love is, okay, it's the holidays, it's someone's birthday, we got to make sure we bring in treats. But a lot of times, that's not really what the kids look forward to the most or what they remember the most either. And so if you think about birthdays in a classroom of 25 kids, if you have 25 birthdays, that's 25 days out of the year where they're eating a cupcake, that's probably over half of their daily calorie needs in that one little birthday party. That really starts to add up for a while, and really what the kids remember is that they did something fun for somebody's birthday. They got to take a break from class and play a game for a Halloween party, not necessarily the treats that they're getting.
So it sounds like just enhancing the overall experience and making it a richer experience at school, that, you know, in a way that maybe we hadn't thought about was possible before.
Yeah, I think so. We had a really great birthday story just from someone in our staff. She has a first grader, and instead of bringing in treats for her son's birthday, she brought in a blank T-shirt, and the kids got to write birthday messages and sign the T-shirt.
Very
so
cool.
He had like something cool to come home with that day, and the kids all thought it was neat because it's something they hadn't seen before. And so there are just ways to go around it, and really, I would say 9 times out of 10, it's not the food the kids are remembering anyway.
Well, we actually have one of our regular callers on the line right now. Drew and Olathe, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to comment, actually. I think part of my issue is sometimes these standards are implemented blanket and they don't. I'm not saying with the kids, but I mean, like, for example, with the ice cream bar, great idea, instead of using milk, like animal-based milk, would be to use coconut, which I think tastes quite creamy and doesn't have actual saturated fat, you know. It's actually healthy types of chemicals in there as compared to, you know, cow milk. And then one of you had brought up cookies and homemade cookies. And, of course, we know these prepackaged cookies have heaven knows what chemicals in them. And then there's also the fact that we need to remember, I'm sure all of you ladies have heard of this crusade against sugar and sugar's causing cancer and blah, blah, blah. And I think one of the problems that we're looking at when we're looking at sugar and saying that sugar's a problem is we're looking at actually things that which have corn syrup put in them, not actual cane sugar, not something that the human body is going to digest more easily. If you know where I'm coming from, and I would also like to actually put the suggestion you were saying options. When kids have a salad bar, you know, offer heirloom tomatoes, you know, stuff that's going to perk up their taste buds and have more nutritional value, as well as, I know this sounds crazy out here, but I'm just giving it a suggestion, sushi or kimchi. You know, I think, you know, one of these is a great-tasting probiotic, which kids might actually like.
Mm-hmm.
Because
mm-hmm.
It's so different. Because, you know, our schools are structured, I think a lot of times around, I don't know, Anglo-Saxon food with maybe a little bit of variety here and there, but not too much. And I also think, I don't know how it's been with the schools around, about sourcing like locally grown, or is that not so common?
You know, it's really tough, and that goes to a little bit, two things I'll talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Our farm-to-school director is actually working really hard because the food service directors have such a challenge with the limited budget and the regulations they have to meet, not only for how to purchase food, but what they can serve on the plates. And really what we're trying to do with our farm-to-school academies, we also have a food service leadership academy, and what it does is it brings together all the food service directors from around the area to talk about those things. And so there's a few districts in the area that are doing that really well, but they kind of do it one produce item at a time. And how to connect farmers with schools so farmers know how to grow the amount a school cafeteria would need, and that schools also know how to write a contract so a farmer can then plan ahead for those types of items. And it's a pretty complex system, but we are definitely in Kansas City. There's a lot of energy around it, and schools really have been receptive to that issue. I think the second thing you brought up was culturally sensitive items. And that, I mean, some again, our kids are so great. This summer I got the opportunity to work with Bethel Neighborhood Center in KCK. Mm. And they are mostly serving new Americans in the region. So a lot of Bhutanese and Nepali immigrants. And their summer food program, a lot of times they were getting donations from harvesters, and they were trying to provide the kids healthy snacks throughout the day. And a lot of times the kids weren't eating it, and the kids talked about how these type of, like a peanut butter and jelly, wasn't something their palate was used to. And so the kids actually wrote suggestions on, well, what type of foods would they like to eat as a snack, And then sharing that not only with Harvesters, who was doing a great thing by providing snacks for the center, also sharing it with the food service director in KCK, who we have a pretty good relationship with, of just how to incorporate some of these foods into at least having an option in the school cafeteria or an option in the summer feeding sites for kids who may not know the American food system as well. And
I would actually love to actually see the reverse happen with kids who are white, who are black, who, you know, are not as much used to having, like you said, the Bhutanese food and all this. Would, because, you know, I also think, you know, someone had told me about being a super taster and having a kid who was a super taster and being so hard, them being so difficult for them because their palate's so sensitive. And if you can't find within the normal, conventional American food palate, you know, I feel like this is also another reason why we need to find more option to make sure that certain things are nutritionally accessible to them. They might find exotic food that they like, which provides them the nutrition they need. Just another thing I was going to add.
I'm going to jump in there and agree with Drew, and thanks for the call, Drew.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. But I'm going to jump in and agree with him that my kid likes a lot of different foods.
Mm.
And it's very frustrating to me when you go places and there's this idea of what children's food is.
Mm-hmm.
And children's food is chicken nuggets, hot dogs, and maybe macaroni and cheese. Slather it all in ketchup. If they don't have something that is basically not a hot dog or chicken nuggets, if they have something that's not that, the waiter often apologizes to me. Yeah. I'm sorry, we don't have any food that kids will eat. I was like, you mean food?
Yeah.
It is a really strange thing that we've got this concept that kids will only eat these foods, and I wonder if it's just because we only feed kids that food.
Yeah.
I think that might be a little bit of a double-edged sword. So there's a huge marketing aspect to those types of foods are marketed towards kids, so we are just kind of bred to think that is kids' food. On the other side is, I think a lot of times the processed foods, the quick and easy, are what's accessible for families. And a lot of times, especially if you live in a neighborhood that doesn't have a farmer's market, doesn't have a full-service grocery store, those processed things that will live on the shelf for a long time that are usually cheaper, too, may be all you have access to. And so a lot of the work we're trying to do is eliminate that access barrier for families and neighborhoods, because if all you have access to is processed, cheaper foods, your palate isn't going to like fresh fruits and vegetables, and then you're set up from a young age to basically always go for those type of foods.
Yeah. Go ahead. Just the other day, my mom is pretty much a vegan for the most part, and she's introduced my niece and nephew to eggplants, and they like them. They like zucchini. Mm-hmm. They like the sweet mini bell peppers, and they don't know to say, hey, will you go to the grocery store and buy me an eggplant? I mean, because they're 3 and 7, but the fact that we were eating it, and then she just offers it to them, and they're, oh, yeah, I like that. So now it's something that they know they like, and they'll eat, and that may not necessarily be on the kids' menu as an idea, but a 7 and 3 year old that I know actually do like those types of foods. So,
and that's a big part of our farm to school initiative too. Is we work and they do tastings within the school. So this spring we did one on radishes, and a lot of kids had never had one before. And they tasted it raw and roasted. So raw, they're very spicy. Roasted, they're pretty sweet. And then also encouraging schools to start a schoolyard garden. So if the kids are growing the vegetables, they're much more likely to try
them.
At least try it is all they need to do.
And even if they just pick them. Mm-hmm. I know that I had Brussels sprouts growing at my house. Mm-hmm. And you know how there's this stereotype with kids and Brussels sprouts.
Yeah.
And some kids came over and they were like, well, what's that? They're Brussels sprouts. And they're kind of, what? Yeah, they were really intrigued by how the plant looked and how it was. I said, pick one off of there and eat it. Just pick it right off of there and eat it right now. And, you know, a raw Brussels sprout is kind of spicy. It's kind of like a radish. It's a little bit. And before I knew it, these kids had picked my Brussels sprouts. clean, which wasn't exactly what I wanted them to do, but I was very pleased that these kids discovered that they like Brussels sprouts too. But the whole crop of Brussels sprouts, it was like a swarm of children came and...
It seems like this, too, can take just a lot of maybe unnecessary stress off of the adults, like thinking we have to come up with all of the answers. And so inviting the children to the table to discuss and, you know, and make decisions and make suggestions expands even our scope of, oh, okay, you know, just as you were referring to earlier. So maybe even changing the adult's take on, you know, your child may be more intuitive or may be able to offer more suggestions than you think.
Yeah, I think so. And it also, it immediately creates buy-in if you're bringing them into the decision-making process. So whether that's in your own home with your own kids or at a school-wide level for a teacher or a principal, I think a lot of times we always think we have to trick kids into eating the healthy things. And I think if you just invite them in from the beginning, it makes it so much easier.
I absolutely agree. You have an event coming up, which we better talk about because we're almost out of time.
Yes.
This has been a great conversation.
Yeah. So on March 2nd, we have our big I Am Here event. And really what we do is we bring together all of these kids who have gone through the training, who are advocating for healthy changes in their community or their school. And we're connecting them with what we call I Am Here heroes. So people who want to volunteer to help them finish a project, people who are connected to different industries who may be able to assist a school or a community in, let's say, building a school garden, finishing a playground, repairing a sidewalk, or people who just want to be a cheerleader for these kids and say, we hear you, these are great ideas, I'm so glad that you were able to come out and do this. So it's, we're I Am Here right now is in its first year, and we're partnering with 24 schools, so that's a lot of voices of kids that we're collecting and great ideas that they have for kind of reshaping Kansas City. And we need to connect them with, you know, business leaders, church leaders, local politicians, anybody who's interested in helping. And so that's what that event on March 2nd is going to be. So a celebration and kind of a let's bring everybody to the table event.
How many years have you been doing this program?
This is the third year for it. So, like I mentioned earlier, it started 3 years ago as just that photo contest. And then last year, we've kind of developed this comprehensive program with the help of our partners and a lot of educators in the area. And so this is the first school year where we're really hitting the ground running with the program. So we're really excited to see the possibilities of this year.
Well, this just seems to have so many benefits even outside of health. I mean, and health is really important. But I'm hearing kids who are going to have wonderful things to put on a college application. And introducing them into community service, into civic government, into having a voice as a voter, and becoming an active citizen in much more ways than just eating a parfait instead of ice cream.
And farming, and, you know, because if they take place in even having a garden of their own, that may lead them to explore more different types of career opportunities as well.
Yeah, the goal is to build civically aware and empowered kids. Our lens and framework for doing that, it just happens to be health, and I think that's important just because it affects just about every other aspect of your life.
Yeah. Well, Michelle, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I think this was a wonderful conversation, and I hope that we get to do it again in the future and continue the dialogue. Listeners were excited about this, and I'm excited about it.
I'm excited
hearing about what else kids are going to come up with in the future.
Sure.
And where, if we want to find out more information about actually signing up for the event or something like that, where do we go for that?
Sure. You can get lots of information at kchealthykids.org. It's our website. Or you can contact me directly at mdake@kchealthykids.org. And all of our contact info is up there. And we office in downtown KCK, but we do serve Missouri and Kansas. So anywhere you are in the metro, we'd love to hear from you.
Well, thank you very much. And we're going to pause for station break, and then we're going to come back with the interview with the Epilepsy Foundation. Stay tuned.
of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
This interview is being pre-recorded Friday morning, November 6th, with Bridget Patterson from the Epilepsy Foundation of Missouri and Kansas. I hope I got that in the right order. And also an intern at KKFI on Every Woman, Beth Wilkinson. And we're going to talk about epilepsy today with Bridget, who has a lot of information to share, and also with Beth, who has epilepsy. And so this is just a foreign topic to me. I know nothing about it. So welcome, Bridget.
Thank you.
Beth.
Thank you.
And starting out with a little bit maybe about your background with the foundation, how long have you been with them?
My background is in electroneurodiagnostics, which is just a big word, meaning that I do brain studies and I analyze and read EEG. I came on with the foundation the first of this year. The foundation is a national nonprofit with 47 affiliate organizations throughout the United States, and we've led the fight against epilepsy since 1968. I came on board with them, like I said, the first part of the year, and I absolutely love it.
Great. Now, I also understand that you have a son who's had epilepsy for 10 years.
Yes. Colby was diagnosed at 8 years old. He is now 18. He is a senior at his high school. His epilepsy developed with absence seizures, which are the staring spell type seizures. And it'll be 3 years in January that they have evolved into the tonic-clonic or convulsive type seizures.
You just stated two terms that need explanation to me.
Absence seizures are staring spells. They're a generalized seizure that involves the entire brain at the same time, and they're just very short in duration, maybe 1 to 10 seconds, staring spell. So there's that lapse of awareness at that time.
Would he have even been aware of that?
When they're very short in nature, no. But as they grew longer in duration, then yes. Okay. For us, it would be like if we're talking on a cell phone and we are getting a bad reception area and we miss bits and pieces of the conversation. That's what it's kind of like for someone that is having absence seizures. They have awareness, and then little bits of time are missed during that seizure, and then consciousness and that is regained to where they have that awareness again.
And you say just 3 years ago he began the sort of what you'd call maybe full-blown seizures?
Yeah, they used to be called grand mal seizures, and now they've renamed them because it's a representation of what happens to your body. Tonic, meaning you become very, very stiff and rigid. Clonic is the convulsive aspect of the seizure, so it's a convulsive type seizure. And again, it's a generalized seizure type as well, and he began having those. It'll be 3 years in January. Sunday, which marked our Seize the Day 5K event, he was 6 months seizure-free from one of those type of seizure events. So that was a really good thing.
Now, is there medication that can help control this?
Yes. He is refractory, meaning his medications don't fully control his epilepsy. He's on his 6th, 7th, and 8th medications right now. But a lot of times, medications do control folks' seizure activity.
And it's something that people, and especially children, can grow out of throughout years, their teenage years?
Yes. Absence epilepsy, 70 to 80% of kiddos grow out of absence seizures. Colby's just didn't. His evolved into multiple seizure types.
Right, right.
So you say you can grow out of it? You mean it can go away?
Yes.
Sometimes people don't understand, and they can see this type of reaction to being in an environment, and a lot of times, was it something that he had with a kind of busyness, I mean, like a stressful kind of environment that he was in?
Not those are precipitants or triggers to epilepsy, and a lot of the different forms of seizures have those precipitants, whether it's fatigue and being tired, lack of sleep, stress, anxiety, heat, overexertion, all of those kind of things, flashing lights, hyperventilation or a very deep breathing if they're involved in sports or running and that sort of thing can be seizure triggers.
Something I've heard also is diet, kind of structured kind of environment, kind of diet and missing some kind of meal or something, is that?
Well, there is a form of treatment called the ketogenic diet.
Right,
and
right.
When Colby was 15, we tried more of a modified Atkins approach to the ketogenic. And what it does is it puts your body in ketosis, meaning that the more fat that you intake, that is burning your energy and not carbohydrates. So he was restricted to 20 carbs in a full day and 333 grams of fat, which is equivalent to about 3 cups of heavy whipping cream. So that meant no more pizza, no more pasta, no more breadsticks, although he didn't like me very well during that time period. He did have some reduction in his seizure activity, but not enough to offset how incredibly hard and difficult that diet was for him. But it works for some people, and some people become seizure-free. It's usually used for smaller children. I have talked with people that when they keep their carb intake at a lower level, then it does help to decrease their seizure activity.
Yeah, and that's something I kind of got from the international kind of publications of the diet and then just so many on the age where just reaction to many things and the different age levels. I received brochures and things in that manner that had to do with infants, just children to a certain age, and teenagers, and then beyond teenage, middle age, and seniors also. So it's quite, you can look it up and kind of go online and see what they have to share with you or see what you.
Yes, it's not age or gender specific.
Right.
And it's brought on, and I don't know if you have any statistics, you say it's hereditary or it's brought on by...
Well, common causes of epilepsy, if it's not something that's known like a brain trauma due to an accident where there's head injury sort of thing, brain tumors perhaps, maybe infections of the brain took place like meningitis, encephalitis, measles, that sort of thing. Maybe there was a brain injury at birth where the umbilical cord got wrapped around that baby's neck and they had lack of oxygen, therefore resulting in seizures. Or maybe it was just abnormal brain development from the get-go. It's usually a genetic thing. And we have a gazillion genes in our body, and there isn't testing for every single one of them. So when we think that it's a genetic thing, but it can't be tested, like I've had Colby tested through the gamut with autoimmune disorders and the genetic testing for epilepsy, and everything has been negative, but it's still probably a genetic issue. We call that idiopathic. We're just kind of idiots. We have no clue. But we're certain it's somewhere in there. No, we are. We are. We can't figure that out.
Well, sometimes the doctors can be, too. I mean, you make
a decision. That is a medical term.
Yeah.
Doctors. Yeah. Then the onset for you, Beth, how was your onset?
It was a traumatic brain injury, and sometimes the physician or the medical field, they say TBI. And here I can say many others, but I know with my traumatic brain injury, it was coma after my injury, and you kind of wake up from that. Usually you want to have a shorter period of time. Anything extended, like to a week or beyond that, you're going to have a really tough time. But I had a 3-day coma. And kind of everything, my son was 2 years old, so I kind of have to rebuild things with him. And it was a real challenge. But my son was just, he's 31 now, and so he kind of was there for me. And you can't say exactly, we had fun, but my degree is in teaching, so I just switched my degree into art. And so I've been an art therapist, an art teacher, and beyond, you can just find many avenues to take.
Now, what happened after that coma, and when was your first seizure?
I was riding a horse, as a matter of fact, and it wasn't my horse. But the horse was excited to get back to the barn, and it went into pavement. So it basically fell on me, because it was just something. But it wasn't a very good horse, and I think they put it down because they were just so angry with it.
Now that's what caused your coma, or that's what?
Yeah,
your first onset.
Yeah, well, having like a horse fall on you, it's something that you kind of.
And it caused a brain injury, or you ended
up with a coma, yeah. And then brain injury, and then but it took years before I had. I mean, probably 10 years before I had any kind of seizure.
Okay, and so, how did that seizure come about?
Just basically,
know you were having a seizure?
No, they were grandmas, and then there would be times where there was an extension of time where I didn't drive or things in that manner. So, which is fine because I was in school at the university, and for 5 years I didn't drive a car, but I had a bike that I rode and. Really, it didn't bother me.
And did you have any idea when an onset of a seizure was going to happen?
Not really. I didn't have a neurologist back then. I mean, I probably had one initially after the injury, but just I was independent and didn't care for anybody to be in my life in that manner. So when it started, it was just something I went on to Dilantin, and now they know that Dilantin is something that's not a good thing for people with a diagnosis in epileptic seizures.
What did Dilantin do for you?
It made me weak. I break bones very easily, and I've got my arms and legs that have done that. So,
how long were you on that?
Years. I was up in Minneapolis, and then I came back down to school. I was working on getting my master's and going into being a Montessori teacher, and it was just like things started happening, and I moved to Kansas, and then it was just like everything was a lot stronger, and so it was a challenge, but...
Now, you mean coming to Kansas was helpful for you?
No. That's when all the broken bones started happening.
Oh, okay. What do you know about this Dilantin?
Well, all medications, whether they're seizure medications or not, are going to have some side effects. And seizure medications are referred to as AEDs, anti-epileptic drugs. They're right under chemotherapy drugs and side effects. And so some of them do have some, pretty severe side effects from time to time. It doesn't affect everyone like that. And Dilantin works for some people, and some people it does not.
Recently, I've seen an advertisement on television about a man talking about now he can drive because of some drug. And that made me wonder. Do you have a problem driving, Beth?
No, not really. I had an implant called a nerve stimulator, and it's something that they do. They do research onto where the stimulus in your nerves go to. And basically what they do is there's two different areas that they put the implant into. Mine is one of the newer ones that they were working on that was on the chest. So I have connections to the part of my brain that got damaged. So it's you can work with. I got to the point where I had two neurologists in Kansas City, and I've gotten to the third one. And there was one that was just excellent, but there were two that they wanted to do brain surgery. I mean, it was just like, and it wasn't with the implant, the nerve stimulator, I kind of said goodbye to those, and I found a great doctor in Lawrence, and I live right by the hospital, so I have my neurologist, I have my general physician, and almost my dentist within just areas, and I can drive if I want, and I drove big my doggy wagon. I'm getting a new car, and so I kind of had to make some changes there. I'm sorry. I just feel very strong that changes can happen, and there's strengths, and Bridget knows.
Sure, there are. And as far as driving goes, it's more of a safety. Missouri and Kansas have the same recommendation of 6 months from the point of last seizure. Colby cannot drive, and I applaud you for not allowing epilepsy to define you as a person, and we don't allow epilepsy to define us in our home either. He does have limitations, like he cannot drive due to the frequency of his seizure activity, but that's to keep him safe and others on the road as well. It would result in an accident that could be, you know, death to himself or someone, and that's not a good thing. But for every one thing he can't do, we try to find two more that he can do very, very well and be successful at. So we don't let epilepsy define us. We jump right out in life and make a difference. And I think it's important to have that perspective in
life.
Bravo.
I mean, that's the way to look at it.
Now I'm like, do I understand that there isn't really a medication that can keep you safe from all of a sudden you go into a seizure?
Sure, there's many people that are controlled with medications that have not had a seizure in a very, very long time. That are controlled with medication, but some folks are just refractory, meaning those medications do not control their seizure activity.
And then you change. There's new ones that come out, and you can kind of check them out. And
you modify your lifestyle. For example, I have macular degeneration, and I don't drive at night. I'm still able to pass the driver's test annually to keep my Kansas driver's license, but it's limited to no night driving, no freeway, and no more than 30 miles from home. And so I haven't driven at night myself since February 2012 when I sideswiped a car. I said, that's it, I'm done. And thank goodness for Uber and friends and other ways to compensate for that.
Sure. I think we make those type of accommodations. Colby's seizure activity is more prominent 20 to 30 minutes upon wakening, whether that's at 6:30 in the morning when he's getting up, getting ready for school, or if it's 10:30 in the morning on a Saturday where he slept in. So obviously we don't go water skiing first thing in the morning, or we don't go out and do things that would be problematic to that seizure activity first thing, but we get past that point, and then it's really not of any major concern at that point.
And when a seizure happens, what takes place? You said Colby hadn't had one for 6 months?
No, not a tonic-clonic event. His absent seizures are multiple daily. On an absent seizure with a staring spell, there really isn't any kind of first aid that's necessary unless an injury would result because of the seizure. Maybe he had that staring or blanking out when he was at the top of the steps and he would fall or something of that nature. Then, of course, there would be, you know, medical assistance that could be necessary. On a tonic-clonic event, Colby stops breathing. So I have a rescue med. We use diazepam. I have a rescue med that I give him at the onset of a seizure. And at that time, he's going to lose consciousness because it's a generalized seizure type. So he's going to lose consciousness. He stops breathing, and he has the convulsions. And so medical assistance is necessary to, you know, to keep him safe during that time.
And usually, I mean, a lot of people don't understand how to work with that and the time where you need to, like...
Yeah. The biggest thing is to stay calm and track time. Because if you're freaking out, if you're trying to help somebody, you're not going to be of help to them because you are, you know, out of control yourself. But seizures can be very, very scary. They truly can. And so staying calm and being able to keep your senses and your wits about you in order to help that person, we're going to track time because we never want a seizure lasting longer than 5 minutes, or that person may have a seizure rescue med. So I'm not going to go by general guidelines with Colby and wait 5 minutes before I would administer a rescue med if he's not breathing. That would be extremely problematic for him. And so I'm going to give it to him at the onset. If someone doesn't have a rescue med, maybe their seizures aren't as violence in nature. Maybe the breathing isn't an aspect, but they may bite their tongue, they may foam at the mouth, all of that sort of thing. We're going to always roll them up on their side, and we do that for two reasons. We do that to open the airway, and that if there is any secretions from their mouth, that it's draining from the side, and it's not something that they can aspirate back in their lungs. And then we're going to protect that head. We're going to protect other aspects of their body as well, but we're really going to protect that head so it's not banging into the wall or to the floor or whatever flooring surface it is. We're going to protect that head. And then we're going to stay with them until that full awareness is regained. Some folks have an aura, which means that it's kind of a precursor, kind of a heads up or a feeling or a taste or just a sense that here it comes kind of thing. Colby does not have that. You get that a lot with your partial or your focal epilepsies. He does not have that, so he doesn't know that one is coming on. When they happen, they just happen. But I'm going to stay with him because I don't want clustering to happen. I don't want that to be something that another seizure occurs without full consciousness being regained, because we would consider that a medical emergency.
And also you want to focus on what the stereotypes are. That's something that just, if I'm working in a situation where I might have any kind of reaction or what happens, it just is, you want to have a medical ID, and you also want to let people know that you do not put anything in the mouth, and it does not matter which side the person has to be on. It's basically just kind of knowing that it's something that is not as, dramatic for them.
Correct. And you don't ever put anything in their mouth. There was always the stigma of that epilepsy was, and seizures were a mental illness, and oh my gosh, put something in their mouth so they won't swallow your tongue. You cannot swallow your tongue because it's attached. So we never, ever put anything in a person's mouth that's having a seizure.
Do they tend to bite their tongues?
They can. Colby never has. But I have patients that have many times, and it's going to hurt like crazy, and it's going to be sore, but it is one of the fastest healing organs in our body, and it's unfortunate that it has to happen, but there's more damage that can be done by putting something in their mouth to protect it than just allowing it to take place.
I'm wondering if there would be a lot of anxiety. Does Colby have anxiety? Do you have anxiety, Beth? Wondering, when is this going to happen again? Do you have warning signs?
Basically, I have the implant that was put onto me. I have a magnet which stimulates the and prevents anything from happening towards a seizure. And I let people know with that magnet, that's what kind of gets me out of any kind of a reaction. So I can I actually have one in my pocket, you know, that I bring with me, and I have the instincts to use it, and it'll just bring me back, and there's no anxieties or anything for me.
So that means you can lead a normal life?
Yes, I do. I basically
you can drive. You can do
right.
Yeah.
Right.
But that doesn't that work for all people?
It just depends on the severity of their epilepsy. Mm-hmm. Colby, I would say he lives a very, very normal life. Mm-hmm. He can't drive. That's just a limitation. Mm-hmm. But like I said, for every one thing he can't do, we find two or three others that he can.
Would this implant work for him?
It's possible. There are different treatment options for different people depending on what type of epilepsy and where their seizures are occurring. What Beth is referring to is a vagal nerve stimulator, and it's implanted in the left-hand side of the chest underneath the skin, and it has electrodes that go and wrap around the vagal nerve in the neck. The vagal nerve then acts as a pathway to the brain, and that the VNS device will deliver intermittent electrical stimulation up the vagal nerve and into the brain in an attempt to lessen the duration, frequency, or even the onset of a seizure.
That's a lot of information I should know. I would have to get my little notebook out. And now this is what goes on with
me. I'm sitting here thinking medical technology is amazing.
Absolutely.
And I guess there keep coming improvements, and there's always hope. I even hope that my macular degeneration can be reversed and cured one day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Amazing, amazing stuff. I've learned a lot today. Probably won't remember. Couldn't repeat hardly anything. Yeah, but
I'm looking at the sheets here,
but,
and there's a lot of information.
Yeah, we're and we've been talking with Bridget Patterson with the Epilepsy Foundation of Missouri and Kansas, and Beth Wilkinson, who's an intern at KKFI, and epilepsy. I don't know, what do you call it? Epilepsy patient, survivor.
What do you like to be called?
Pretty much, I have
nothing. I refer to Colby as an amazing young man who has seizures.
Yeah. I would say understanding that. I mean, you've been in a coma way back when, and you've had to learn what's the best for you.
Okay, so thank you for coming today, both of you, and sharing this information. And Bridget, could you tell listeners where they can learn more information? And
we are located at the Research Medical Center at 2340 East Meyer Boulevard in Kansas City. Our phone number is 816-444-2800, and we go out and I speak to schools and businesses and educate them on seizure protocol and different seizure types and what to look for and that first aid that accompanies those different seizure types. So we would be more than happy to provide any kind of information and resources that we possibly can.
Do you want to give a website and a phone number?
Our website is www.efmk for Epilepsy Foundation of Missouri and Kansas.org.
And your phone number again?
816-444-2800.
And you are in there, Bridget Patterson, and Joni?
Joni Miller is our executive director, and I'm our program director here in our Kansas City office.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Great. And Beth, thank you for sharing your experience.
Thank you. It's I want to share information that I've had to go through.
Yeah, that's great. So life is worth living regardless. So
yes, absolutely.
What obstacles we must overcome.
Right. I want to mention this. I see people on that don't have cars, and there's just such an incident where not everybody drives, and it's something you can handle. And there's so many options you can have. And I'm happy that I'm here, able to come to the studio and work with you.
Great.
Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Sharon.
Thanks, Bridget Patterson.
Thank you for having me.